The Guardian Football Weekly, sponsored by PES 2012. Released October 14th for PS3 and Xbox 360.
Today, Anfield drama. Steven Gerrard is back. Liverpool so excited they let a little pee spoil their clean sheet. Was a point enough for the Reds, and what awaits for United when they go incontinent in Romania? We round up that and the other weekend action. We look forward to Man City, Chelsea and Arsenal in the Champions League midweek too, and ask if the Gunners are kleptomaniacs because they have to keep robbing. We look abroad. France, Philippe Auclair has the Ligue 1 latest and the French view on Joe Cole, and a record-breaking weekend in Serie A. A whole 5 games of 10 had goals in them. Weekend indeed with so many zeros, Michael Bay is making a film of it. All of that, plus post tweets, etc. in today's Football Week. Well, hello everybody. Brand new week. It's been an exciting weekend. On board we have Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hi Barry, you're looking well?
I'm not feeling well.
All right then. Alongside him, Michael Cox, aka ZonalMarking.net. You're looking well as well, Michael.
Thank you, James. Nice to see you.
Yes, indeed it is. And Philippe Auclair, radiant, twinkly as ever. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Now, basically, your job, fellows, is to explain to Barry what happened over the last 48 hours. Very little of which he can remember. Shall we start with Liverpool-Man United?
Why not?
Why not? Who saw this game?
Yeah, I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Watched it as well.
Good.
So did I. One of very few games I saw this weekend.
All right then, Barry. A good result for who?
I would suggest it was probably a good result for Manchester United because I thought Liverpool should have won and didn't, obviously. And then there has been some controversy since over comments Luis Suarez may or may not have made to Patrice Evra. Evra claims he racially abused him
10 times.
Suarez emphatically denies it, so one of them is telling fibs. We don't know who, though.
It does seem a particularly dull-minded way of abusing somebody just to repeatedly use the N-word at them, if that's indeed what he's been charged with doing.
It's not exactly wildly in quippery or anything. Dorothy Parker won't have anything to worry about. But, it's a horrible thing to do if he did it. But,
and it's a horrible thing to allege if he didn't.
Yeah.
Michael, your take on the game?
I didn't think it was a very good game, to be honest. I didn't think there were any real creative, talented players at their best in the game. I think United's selection was quite negative. I think Ferguson was happy with the draw. The use of Phil Jones, Darren Fletcher, Park Ji-sung when he's leaving Rooney and Nani on the bench is quite a negative move, which he's entirely entitled to do, but I don't think it made for the best spectacle. And I thought United were a little bit lucky to get in the game late on. I mean, there was no great strategy of them going up the pitch. They just said, you know, here's Nani, here's Rooney, here's Hernandez, and kind of bundled them all into the box, and eventually Hernandez popped up with a goal, but I didn't think it was a very good game. I thought the game needed someone like, you know, Juan Mata, who was fantastic at the weekend, David Silva, who's been fantastic for City this season. There was no one like that on the pitch. Mm. There was a lot of quite functional players who were, I thought, more concerned with tracking their opponents and doing their defensive work than scoring goals themselves.
And one of the few players who could have done something creatively was Ashley Young, who was there. Ashley Young without Wayne Rooney is not the same player. I mean, there's already a partnership, a relationship has been established there from the beginning of the season. Rooney being on the bench, Ashley Young was he was actually not very well used. And the fact of putting Phil Jones as well there as a central midfielder, a job which he did rather well, actually, which shows what a good footballer he is. You know, he's a central defender who also plays as a right back. Then suddenly Ferguson tells him, OK, you're going to be in midfield, and high up in midfield, and does a decent job. But it looked disjointed to me. It didn't look like a tactical system. And I must say, I'm asking myself questions. You know, you think, is it because there's a big Champions League game coming? But come on, the big Champions League game is against Galati. OK, they have to win it. They should win it. Against probably one of the weakest, if not the weakest team in the competition in the Champions League this season. So you're wondering, what is it? Was it Ferguson telling Dalglish, I think you're not very good, I can beat you even with those guys? It's a typical gamble that paid off, actually, in the end. The point was good.
Well, the point was good. One of the biggest surprises in the lineup was the fact that Wayne Rooney wasn't there. What did you make of that? The ongoing fallout from the 3-game ban he's picked up for the European Championships. This was because his head wasn't in the right place?
I don't think so.
Well, Ferguson said that was the reason, but
that's probably wrong.
Seems a bit odd.
So why would he have left him out?
I don't know. I was sort of bewildered by his team selection, and I was going to ask if either of our esteemed experts here might be able to shed any light on the subject.
Michael, Rooney fallout, you know, nothing that a transplant can help.
I don't really understand why he would have left him out for this reason about the ban. I mean, it was 8 days since the sending off. And I think that Wayne Rooney...
But he just had the news that he was probably going to miss.
He had, but I mean, Wayne Rooney's been suspended enough times to have got over that.
Yeah, but
of
missing
thing,
a whole European championship.
The group stage, James. He'll be back
as
for
I
the
say,
big...
missing a whole European championship.
But honestly, with Ferguson's selection, I could understand the reasons why he went with three central midfielders, because they haven't conceded a lot of goals this season, but they've let a lot of shots on target. And I think they needed to be more secure in that zone. But I was disappointed to see... No Nani in the side, for example. I mean, Jose Enrique is a very good fullback, but I'm not sure you need Park on him. I think Jose Enrique might be a little bit more vulnerable if you attack him. He seems quite reluctant to come out of his position if he's got a lot of defensive work to do. And with Park there, he was constantly steaming forward. Had a decent game, but his nervous moments came when he had to defend. He got caught in possession a couple of times at the back. I don't really understand why Rooney didn't play, to be honest. And then when he came on, he played really deep, didn't he? Almost as a midfielder, which was kind of strange.
What did you make as well of Sir Alex's remarks afterwards that United had played all their big opponents now and failed to mention the derby coming up with Man City next weekend? A simple omission or something more than that?
I think he was just having a wind-up, wasn't he?
City, meanwhile, looking very impressive, resting all sorts of players. Some weren't available anyway, but steaming past Aston Villa without any trouble at all.
Yeah, and it was interesting that they essentially went back to the way they played last season with, you know, three central midfielders of Toure, De Jong and Gareth Barry, which everyone considered very defensive-minded last season. But they seem to have kept the momentum from earlier this season. And even with those quite negative central midfielders, they still scored 4 goals.
Indeed they did. They're going to be playing Villarreal, who've had a rotten start to the time to life in the Champions League this season. Yet to make an impact, though, City in Europe, a draw with Napoli and then that defeat at Bayern Munich.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I would say that in both games, after 20 minutes, I thought that they would actually slaughter what was in front of them. I think there's a little bit maybe too much nervosity before their game. Even though there are a number of players in the City side who have played European football before, I think people were very, very too critical of them after the defeat against Bayern in particular, because they really rang rings around Bayern for 20 minutes. They were the better side.
What about the other 70 minutes? Does that not?
Well, that's just that they tried to play too quickly. They were a little bit overexcited. I think they're just learning Champions League football at the moment, which seems strange when you look at the players who are on the pitch. But as a unit, they have very little experience in that. And I think it's quite normal that the first couple of results might not be the ones they were expecting. I still fully expect them to go through the group.
All right, well, we should be hearing from Sid shortly with what kind of resistance Villarreal will be.
Probably not very much, judging by the way they're playing at the moment.
Presumably you expect them to go through at the expense of Napoli then?
Yes.
I think that's quite a big call.
It is quite a big call. Napoli lost this weekend at the arms of little Sebastiano Giovinco, of which more later. But right now, hey... Newcastle played Tottenham and everybody said, oh, this is the wake-up call for Newcastle. This is the big test and they're surely not going to pass it. But they did.
Yeah, it was quite a good game, actually. I was quite annoyed because I'd been saying before the game how good Stephen Taylor had been this season. And then he went and conceded a penalty.
You've made Philippe spill his coffee.
Well, yes, because I remember Stephen Taylor's performance against Arsenal. And he wasn't great that day.
Yeah, never mind. It was a mistake. I wouldn't do it again. But it was quite a good game. The last 20 minutes were fantastic. Yeah. They both just went for it 2-2. There was no thought of defending. And a couple of good goals. Jermaine Defoe's trademark finish. Is that a trademark finish from Defoe, would you say? He spun very quickly and shot it into the corner. And even Shola Ramiobi scored a goal. So it was quite a good day.
Did you understand the way that Harry Redknapp actually decided to go with Van der Vaart and Adebayo and leave Defoe on the bench when they look so good when they've got Adebayo, Defoe and Van der Vaart to help?
I really like Jermaine Defoe. I think he's improved his all-round game a lot. From what Redknapp was saying, I think he's just trying to rotate for the sake of, not even for the sake of fitness, maybe just for the sake of keeping people happy. And then he was asked after the game whether it was a great managerial decision to bring on Defoe. And he said, no, Van der Vaart looked tired, so I just chucked on Defoe. But to be fair, Defoe scored a very good goal, but he should have squared the ball later on for Adebayor.
Who would probably have missed it?
Well, he might have done.
He wasn't one of those days,
but
Adebayor,
it was interesting
wasn't
because,
he?
Because those two have been a very good partnership so far. And just before Defoe did that, Adebayor had done similar. He was in a good position and didn't square. So it just shows with players like that, if you get one incident where they're not working together, it can all fall apart.
One thing which is funny about Newcastle is that they've become one of the most watched teams in France.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, you've got the six guys up front could all come from Ligue 1. They don't at the moment because Pardew is rotating his squad. And
six guys up front?
Well, I mean,
let's count them off.
Okay,
you've got
six guys up front.
You got
Johan Cabaye.
Cabaye.
Okay, yeah. Sylvain Marvaux.
Okay.
Which we haven't seen too much of him, but he's a decent player. Hatem Ben Arfa, which actually had quite an impact when he came on. And has received a few verbal spankings from Alan Pardew, which people are very, very grateful for in France because they think that's what Ben Arfa needs. Dembaba, who actually is, of course, Senegalese, but actually grew up in my hometown.
All right.
Yep. Whom am I forgetting?
Czech Tioté.
Czech Tioté went through. But there's one I'm forgetting. Gabriel Obertan, of course. From Girondins and then Manchester United. So That's quite a French team. So people have become extremely curious about it. And strangely enough, yesterday in France, the big football channel decided to broadcast this, not the Arsenal game, as its main game of the Sunday.
Wow, yet another symbol
times
of
are changing.
Decline. Interesting. We'll talk more about Arsenal perhaps later on. Just wanted to round off part one with Chelsea. Hey, Velios scored. Just like we flagged him up last week. Look out for him, we said.
We know our stuff.
Struggling to find his name. And then he scored. But in other regards, it was pretty much all Chelsea. Andre Villas-Boas a day short of his 34th. This is very upsetting. It's his 34th birthday. He's almost as young as you, Michael. And he's already managing in the Champions League.
Yeah.
Time to step up. but there you go. And they breezed past Everton.
I was at Stamford Bridge, and the first 20 minutes, until the first goal, it was pretty even, as a matter of fact. Everton were quite well organised. Then what happens? I mean, it's a game we've seen so many times at Stamford Bridge where Chelsea are not exactly fluent. Juan Mata was, again, absolutely sensational. But the team was playing, was a bit on the slow side. Didier Drogba looked totally shattered, I must say. I don't know if it's still the consequences of the concussion, if it's the fact that his contract talks are taking a long time to be resolved.
He's never really recovered from that malaria he had.
Well, I mean, last year he actually had a big impact. Torres was being played a lot, but Drogba, when he was actually called on by Ancelotti, did the job and did it very well. If I'm not mistaken, he finished as the top of the assists for Chelsea last season. So I didn't find them entirely convincing. And afterwards, Everton, well, showed their limits, basically, which is they're okay to hold on to results and can scratch a goal here and there. But otherwise, they were quite poor afterwards. They it's just a team that has got no creativity. And David Moyes doesn't seem to be inclined to bring on a lot of creative players in, I must say.
Why? Who's he leaving out?
I don't know. He had Bilayeddinov on the bench, who is a player who can make a difference from time to time. Now, it can be that he was down to, you know, the 17 fit players. Absolutely possible. But otherwise, when you're 3-0 down and you bring on Phil Neville, that's not exactly, I mean, unless you want to avoid a spanking, that's not exactly going to turn the game around, is it?
No. No arguments there, Philippe.
Well, Phil Neville is one of Everton's leading scorers this season.
With one goal.
Yes.
Genk next for Chelsea. Presumably, Fernando Torres comes back in.
Yeah, you'd think so. He should be quite fresh.
And he will.
The kind of game he might score a couple of goals.
But they're scoring
in
bucket loads without him, are they not?
Yeah, they've got a lot of strikers, to be fair. And even Daniel Sturridge, who I think has done really well coming in from the right, says that he wants to play up front later in his Chelsea career, which I can't really see happening. A little bit like Walcott. He seems perfect for the wing, in my view.
Really?
Yeah, and they've also got Lukaku, who's very young and very strong and certainly a centre-forward. So I think Sturridge might have to get used to playing wide.
And Chelsea, no problems against Belgian mid-table side Genk?
I wouldn't have thought so.
Next up, it's Sid with news of Villarreal and all sorts of other Liga business. Part two, and on the line from Spain, it is Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Great. I say you're in Madrid. Where are you?
I am in Madrid, yeah.
And what's happening?
Well, quite a lot in terms of, obviously, all the focus really now is the build-up for the Champions League games this week. But there's been quite a lot of excitement this weekend because Levante have won again. This is just the most improbable story. They're now top of the table, level with Barcelona after seven games. It's not, you know, kind of an early season blip, although of course it is an early season blip because at some stage they'll slip down. But seven games in, five wins, two draws, undefeated, a side whose entire budget wouldn't pay the wages of one or two of the Real Madrid players. It's just absolutely amazing. And this weekend they did it by beating Malaga as well, who, of course, as everybody knows, is the kind of a third team in Spain now, certainly in terms of money.
Financially, yeah. So how are they doing it, Sid?
Well, I love the quote from the doctor. The club's doctor says, "The secret is pizzas and beer." And this is a very carbohydrate high diet. That they're a very, very old side. This weekend they put out the oldest starting 11 in Spanish football history. I think I've forgotten the stat. I think it's 364 is their combined age this weekend. 170 just the goalkeeper and the defenders. They're a team that are quite defensive, very, very conscious of their limitations, very, very good sense of kind of collective spirit. And this started in some ways at the back end of last year, in fact, halfway through last year. They were rock bottom after 20 games and they started to really produce results. And at that stage, the coach, Luis Garcia, was doing all sorts of motivational things with them, like taking them and standing them on the wall and making them throw themselves off the wall into their teammates' arms, really creating a sense of unity. Now, that coach has gone, but the sense of unity, I think, has continued. And it's almost led to a kind of sense of opportunity, I think, for some of the players. Because I think some of them felt that last year's coach ended up being seen by everyone as the only reason they'd survive. And this was a chance for them to say, well, actually, we can play a bit too. But if you go through their squad, it's extraordinary. They shouldn't be anywhere near the top of the table.
Have they had an easy fixture list at the start of the season?
No, well, that's the other thing that you would look at under normal circumstances, isn't it? But, well, they haven't. They've beaten Malaga, who obviously have spent nearly €60 million this summer. They beat Betis, who were the early leaders of La Liga and started the season with four wins in a row and are actually not a bad side at all. And, of course, they beat Real Madrid. They're the one team to have done so. So I think you can't even look at this and say this is a complete fluke. Now, of course, they'll slip away a bit. But I think the organisation, the ability to play on the break, the ability to cede possession and not worry about that too much, which is something that in Spain doesn't happen that often, they're also capable, it is true, of being a little bit nasty when they need to be and playing, as Mourinho complained with a bit of a degree of irony, that they were good at the other football, the time wasting and the throwing themselves to the ground and the theatrics and the fouling, which, as I say, that came after Mourinho's side had been beaten by them.
Right, OK, now Real Madrid, how did they get on? They had some excited posts about the Higuain's performance, Ars Technica, saying classy, classy player.
I mean, yep. James, far be it from me to run the risk of you accusing me of being a corporate patsy once again, but a certain boot-making company who makes boots with power pods and stuff like that, a certain boot-making company changed Gonzalo Higuain's boot 4 games ago. He scored 3 hat-tricks since then.
No.
Yes, it's extraordinary. What, 2 with Real Madrid, 1 with Argentina. I must confess, I wasn't 100% sure if he'd played both of Argentina's games. So on Saturday night, I was getting very excited because I thought, I don't believe it. This is a hat-trick of hat-tricks. Unfortunately, it's not, because he did play in the rubbish Argentina game as well as the good one. But it was a good performance from Real Madrid. The other thing that makes it sort of significant, well, I'll say it was a good performance, it was a good second-half performance. The other thing that makes it significant, it was Cristiano Ronaldo's 100th game. And so, of course, as you can imagine, all the build-up was about, will he be able to get his 100th goal? He was on 96. He didn't score, so he's rubbish, James. He's got only 96 goals in his 100th first games for Real Madrid.
All right. Ars Technica was also getting very excited about Lassana Diarra and indeed Mourinho's performance in turning said player into a good player for a top team playing nice, simple football. None of that messiah complex stuff. And Ars Technica hails this as a great bit of a man management by Jose.
I'm not entirely sure I agree in the sense that Lassana Diarra played very, very well this weekend. I think that over the last few years, he's played far better than the Spanish media has ever been willing to admit. I think that they like to look at him, and because he's the defensive midfielder, I think they like to completely overlook the fact that technically he's not a bad player at all. Also, I'm not convinced that he's changed dramatically because of Mourinho. One of the things that's really interesting is in the summer, Lassana Diarra was really pushing for a move, kept saying he wanted to go, kept saying he'd had enough and he wanted to play much more often. And actually, during that period, Mourinho was saying to him, look, I want you to play. This wasn't a case of Mourinho pushing him to the door. Mourinho did want him to play. I don't think, though, that it's that made Lassana Diarra stay. I think it's what Diarra wanted in wages that ended up making it impossible for him to go.
Now, big midweek, as ever, for the Spanish clubs. Real Madrid particularly, they take on Lyon. Barcelona have Pilsen. And Valencia up against Bayer Leverkusen. Any upsets there?
No, I think Madrid's situation is frankly a little dull, in the sense that, you know, they've already won all their Champions League games. I think they'll go through the group very, very comfortably. a victory against Lyon this week would almost secure it. They'd have 9 points from nine, and that may well be enough to see them go through as group winners.
Philippe spilling his coffee against it.
No, I'm just shaking my head a little bit because it's a good Lyon team, you know, that that Real is going to play. It's a Lyon team that is coming back into the race for the title. And it's a Lyon team that has done quite a few naughty things to Real Madrid in the past very regularly.
Yes. Yes, it is. But you look back at that record, and I think from Real Madrid's point of view, at least, they feel like they broke that psychological duck last year by going to Lyon and playing reasonably well, although it ended up being a draw, by knocking Lyon out. Because, as you say, until then, Madrid had been to the Galán twice and been hammered both times. Last year they went, and because of a Karim Benzema goal, who, by the way, I wasn't aware of just how much of a hero he was in Lyon until last year. Oh. The reaction for the fans was absolutely stunning.
Which is extraordinarily rare as well. You know, in France, we don't, when a player comes back to his former club, generally it's verbal abuse. It's appalling. Whereas Karim Benzema is still God there.
Incidentally, if you fancy a trip to see Real Madrid playing at the Bernabeu, with flights and accommodation quite literally thrown in, plus a copy, ooh, get this, of the PES 2012 game, then that's the fantastic prize that we are going to be offering you in Thursday's show. We're going to be asking you a question in Thursday's show. So anyway, make sure you listen to that and you could be the lucky winner of trip, etc. Sid, a quick word on Villarreal.
A side that I think are in big trouble. They're just not playing well. They're not as creative. They're not as quick as they were. I think the loss of Santi Cazorla is really huge to them. And you know, we talked about this at the very start of this group. I said that I didn't think they'd be the whipping boys, as some in the British media were keen to say. But I did think that they were a side who were weaker than in the past. And sadly, it's looking very much that way.
All right then, Sid. Thank you very much for joining us today. Look forward to catching up with you on Thursday. Hey. Since you're in, Philippe, let's talk about Ligue 1.
And where we are chuffed at the moment because they're goals galore.
Goals galore, yeah?
Yeah, well, it wasn't, you know, normally French league is probably of the five major championships, I mean, the lowest scoring, and we've started this season well.
Right.
I think we had 33 goals this weekend, which isn't bad.
Yeah, if you like goals, yeah. I mean, a lot of people...
Some would suggest they're overrated. I could see Jimbo's getting all defensive goals already.
Yeah. Yes.
True. Typical Italian fashion. Yeah. Well, of course, Joe Cole, that's why, isn't it? How many has he got of them? Well, 33.
He wasn't actually playing this weekend. Him and Eden Hazard were actually rested by Rémi Garcia.
For the big game against Inter.
For the big game against Inter, and also I think there's a big game coming against Lyon after that. So it's a big week for Le LOSC.
But am I right in saying that Joe's not what you might call an automatic starter at Lille? He seems to be.
He has become, yes.
Oh, has he?
What's happened is that he wasn't at the beginning, and it was Dimitri Payet, the recruit from Saint-Etienne, who was starting on the right-hand side. But Dimitri Payet got injured. And that was the best piece of news for Joe Cole, who until then had done, you know, bits and parts and quite well, actually.
Yep.
And then he started to play on the right-hand side,
right.
Of a 4-2-3-1, and has done extremely well. I mean, he looks very, very lively. He's absolutely put everybody in his pocket by his behaviour there, as in he's certainly trying to play to learn French and to speak French. Mm-hmm. He's very open to the media in a way that maybe English journalists don't realize because he was so much more protected when he was at Chelsea. But he's very nice guy, actually, Joe. And he's playing superb football. And what surprises me is that, of course, Ligue 1, you don't maybe need the same levels of fitness as you would in the Premier League. The rhythm, it can be quite high, but there are loads of pauses in the game where you can actually recuperate. But he's been absolutely splendid in terms of physicality as well.
And the French home press, they think you're buying another clapped out Englishman in David Beckham, is that right?
Yeah, well, yeah. That's the marketing operation of Paris Saint-Germain. Ah. It's all but done. That's it. He's already signed a contract as a consultant for Al Jazeera, which happens to be owned by the same company, which is the majority shareholder of Paris Saint-Germain.
On the subject of Joe Cole, there was Dominic Fifield of this parish did an excellent interview with him in The Guardian on Saturday.
With a splendid photograph.
Yes, it looks like he's trying to put Jimbo out of a job, sitting there reading his foreign newspaper outside a cafe. But yeah, he seems really happy over there.
That's no reason why he shouldn't be happy.
No, indeed not.
I think a lot of people were sort of half expecting him to be, you know,
like
commuting.
Jimmy Greaves or whatever.
Yeah.
Not
that is one thing I wanted to comment upon.
Ah.
Because there is this myth that English and British players can't adapt abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it comes from. I'm really
Jimmy Greaves.
Paul Gascoigne.
Ian Rush.
Paul Gascoigne. Talk to all the Laziale. I think they love their Paul Gascoigne.
They do. Did he adapt to the local culture? No.
No, that's a different matter altogether. Right.
But that's actually the subject we were
Jimmy
talking
Greaves,
about.
Okay, but Jimmy Greaves, actually, whilst he was there, was actually very, very good indeed. It was more prime of character and maybe he couldn't find the right boots there, I don't know. But if you look at the others,
yes.
Talking as a Frenchman, we know we had Glenn Hoddle, Chris Waddle, Trevor Stephen, Ray Wilkins, Graham
Tony
Ricks.
Tony
Cascarino, indeed, Mark Hatley. They all did extremely, extremely well. And Laurie Cunningham at Real Madrid, for example, as well. You know, and the list, of course, of players who coming from the English and the Scottish leagues who've done very well abroad is actually a very long one. The failures are just, you know, Jonathan Woodgate, people like that. There's a few you can think of, but most of them actually were successful. It's a myth.
Anyway, there you go. And who's top of the table right now?
Who do you think? The Beckham's Club.
Oh, Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, they're doing very well. They won again at Ajaccio. Kevin Gamero hat-trick.
Right.
He's very, very good purchase indeed. And the way it's going with Javier Pastore being absolutely sublime, there's no other word, you can't see the title going.
And Menez as well.
Yeah, surprisingly. Yeah. I mean, to everybody. Obviously, I don't know, there's something about this club and the way that Antoine Comboiré has managed to hold on to his position has surprised a lot of people. They're playing well, they're playing expansive football. The results are there. Leonardo is doing basically all the bling stuff and Comboiré is just taking care of the nuts and bolts and so far so good, you know, better than that. They are ahead, they've already got 3 points, they're 3 points ahead of Montpellier and Lyon.
Is Raymond Domenech in gainful employment these days?
He's trying, not that I know of, and it's a name that I tried to forget, Barry. You know, who is Raymond Domenech?
What about Laurent Blanc and his you know, those tapes, the recordings? What was the eventual outcome of all of that? Nothing?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely because there nothing. Was absolutely no case to answer. It was a story that was spun out of control by a publicity-hungry website, which was then taken on without any fact-checking by most papers, and I should say in this country as well, the BBC, for example, and it was scandalous and absolutely scandalous. And so actually, if you should read the new issue of the Blizzard, of course, because I hadn't done my plug for the Blizzard, because I wrote a long piece about that, trying to put the story to sleep. I must say I felt very hurt, like many French people were, that Laurent Blanc, who is probably one of the men who's done the most to represent that rainbow nation, rainbow team of 1998, the man who's brought back in the young players of Arab and North African origin within the team, the player who's made Alou Diarra the captain of France, and so forth, that this guy could be accused of racism really sickened me, I have to say.
Right. Okay. No, it did seem quite damning what he was saying in the transcripts.
The transcripts were, first of all, badly translated. They were also put together in a garbled way, putting one sentence from one paragraph in and so forth like that. And they also ignored the fact that Laurent Blanc, when he was recorded secretly, illegally by one of the guys from the FA, who waited 6 months to make the tape public, also said things such as, to me, if my best 11 players were all black, I'd put them on my team, in my French team. I have no problem with that. Wherever they come from doesn't make any difference. They're as French as you and me. These quotes disappeared mysteriously from the transcripts and only to be published later.
Is he taking any kind of action over this?
He should have, but he was forced to apologise, such as political correctness these days.
Abby27 says, why has Sylvain Distin never been capped by France?
It's a mystery to absolutely everybody. I think he left, you know, you've got to remember he made his name in France with Guignon, which is, you know, second division team, and they won the League Cup. Then he moved to PSG. It didn't quite work. That he had to move abroad, but he never played in a top club. He did extremely well in every single English club where he's been, but I don't know why.
All right, final question. Happy Goth says, because we have to get one in from Happy Goth. How was Toots and the Maytals?
It was good.
All right.
It was not as great as it should have been.
All right.
So it's the fault of all
he's
this.
He's 80 now.
No, he was fantastic.
All right, okay.
It's just because gigs have become places where people go there so that they can Facebook and Twitter that they are there and they take pictures.
Right.
It was just ghastly.
Do you ban
having gigs disappointments this week? Sorry, Michael, you had a problem.
No, I was just going to ask, because Philippe is also a musician, of course. Do you ban mobile phones from your gigs? Or if you could, would you?
Yes, of course.
Fair enough.
That's the first thing I do. And the kind of music I do, generally, people are a bit more quiet.
Couple of posts then, eh? Ooh, Dave the Ninja says, Baz has singled out man crushes in Serie A, Cavani, and La Liga, Sergio Ramos now. When did you go for Sergio Ramos? When did that happen?
Well, I've always thought he was quite a handsome man. He looks a bit like Amanda Knox. It occurred to me this morning.
Okay, who is it in the Premier League? Asked Dave the Ninja.
I don't really have one in the Premier League. I'm not some sort of floozy, you know.
Clearly you are, Barry. Who is it in the Premier League? You are incapable of watching football without singling out players for their attractiveness. Yeah, come on, there must be somebody.
Manchester United's new goalkeeper is sort of handsome in a dishevelled,
really
boyish way. Yeah.
You'd like to rumple his.
He looks like something.
I don't
from
want
a
to
Dr.
rumple
Zeus
anyone's
book.
Anything. I'm not Doesn't that say. Way inclined. But I can appreciate the aesthetic qualities of a handsome man.
All right. And that's who you're going for. De Gea. There you go. That settles that. I haven't picked mine. I'll have a think about that. Rick Chasey, which Premiership player would be most likely to survive a bear attack and why? Rick, come
a
on.
Bear.
Now, this is a serious. People are making jokes. This is actually a very serious thing. Sir Jim posting in says, best way to get away from bears is to run downhill. This is because their front legs are shorter than their rear legs, meaning that running down will cause them to fall into an uncontrollable roll, leaving you free to make your escape. There you go. And Culpepper says, the pod possibly saved my life. True story, walking through a forest not more than 100 feet or so. I hear some grunting and scratching. What's this about Barry Glindon? No, I spy a mother bear. That's really... And her two delightful cubs halfway up a tree, looking quizzically at me. Anyway, basically, he remembered the pod advice not to turn around and run, and instead stared at the bear while gently backing away. This is, you know... And, you know, she growled and watched him very carefully indeed, but did not charge. There you go. Well done, Culpepper. We need all the listeners we can get. We saved a man's life. All right, well, part three is on the way. Still plenty to discuss. And, of course, a particularly thrilling weekend in Serie A. Part three, everybody. Arsenal. Joel Abraham says, with 28 goals in 34 matches in 2011, is Robin van Persie the best striker in the league? And my supplementary question, what's the latest Philippe Auclair
on
for Robin van Persie? Can they keep him? Will they keep him? Are they going to smash their wage structure for him?
I don't think they will keep him. I think the only way in which they could keep him, I mean, we're talking, obviously, they're going to keep him for the rest of the season. That is obvious. Mm-hmm. There were even some indications in Wenger's press conference yesterday that they might even want to keep him until the end of his contract. Given the importance that he's taken for the team, that will almost make sense, I must say. It will very much depend on how the club does in the Champions League this season, I would imagine, if they manage to do... they can still finish in the top four. I mean, people forget that they're missing maybe their three best players, three of the five best players. You know, Bakary Sagna, Thomas Vermeulen and Jack Wilshere. That's tough. That's very, very tough. And they could have an excellent post-Christmas part of the season. So I reserve my judgment on that.
Right,
but for Van Persie, I know. I think that he will be on his way out.
They'd have to smash the wage cap for it, and they're not going to do that.
It's not just a question of the wage cap. It goes beyond that. It has to go with the club's ambition and Robin van Persie's ambition as a player who hasn't won anything since 2005 with his club.
Booze at halftime at the Emirates this weekend.
A mixture of. I mean, you know, in the press box, we're actually literally within the Arsenal fans, and there were a few boos. There were just as many people clapping as people booing. It's become, you know, a very dysfunctional place to be in. Second half, I thought the public was actually, the Emirates is supposed to be a library, but the public was absolutely fantastic actually in the second half. Really supported the team as they realized that they needed somebody to prop them up. And because what was happening on the pitch after Larsson's fabulous equalizer was honestly completely incomprehensible. There was nothing. There was no structure. There was no game plan. There was the team looked completely disorganized. The players didn't look particularly interested, or they didn't have any ideas of how they could get back into that game.
So it was all down to those two men, Chesney with his incredible save and Van Persie.
You could say that, yes. And also, I think I wouldn't underestimate the introduction of Andrei Arshavin, who was absolutely superb when he came on. one of the big questions I have about Wenger's handling of the situation is how and why he underuses Arshavin so much. I don't understand.
He's not reliable, though, isn't he? I mean, his form is so flaky.
Again, if you look at the stats last year, he was probably the most efficient when you took goals and assists of all players at Arsenal. The one thing that plays against Andre Arshavin is what I call a game accelerator. He's somebody, when he receives the ball, either he goes directly and attacks the defenders and tries to weave his way, dribbling and so forth, trying to create danger that way, or he tries to speed up the transmission of the ball. When he's playing with people who are technically extremely adept, as were Semir Nasri or Cesc Fabregas or Robin van Persie, that looks good. When he's playing with players who haven't got the same perception of space and movement as he has, which is, I think, exceptional, sometimes it looks like, oh, he's missed a three-yard pass. No, he's just trying to accelerate the pace of the game. I mean, maybe because I'm speaking like an Arshavin fan, but he takes so much stick for what he does. Walcott was terrible. Jovinho completely died on his feet after 50 minutes. There's a lack of creativity in that team.
Marseille? Yeah. That's away, isn't it? Stade Vélodrome.
Stade Vélodrome, 60,000 people there. Oof. It'll be rocking.
Well, they've had a rotten time in the league, haven't they?
Not very good. I mean,
one win in 10, I think I'm right in saying. I've just done that. Actually, somebody posting in this week saying, I get so annoyed when people say, if memory serves, when they're reading a stat. I've just read off a piece of paper, one win in 10.
Yeah.
And that is, I think I'm right in saying.
But only three losses and six draws. It's basically a team that is, again, lacking the attacking thrust that they had. When, for example, Lucho and Mamadou Niang were there together and they had a magnificent relationship. Niang was sold against Didier Deschamps' will. André-Pierre Gignac is back, having shed a couple of stone at Merano because he was, honestly... Can you picture Branislav Ivanovic posterior? It's huge, isn't it? Well, Gignac is like Ivanovic's posterior all over, from the ankle to the neck. It's just he had become this massive guy, like a puffin. And then they sent him to this health farm, and he's come back and apparently all lithe and so forth.
A Marseille win, do you think?
No, I can see Arsenal doing Marseille a very nasty, giving a nasty fright and winning at the Vélodrome.
All right, yep. Okay. A couple of other things from the Premier League meantime this weekend. Bolton winning. There you go, at Wigan. Now. Fantastic stuff for Bolton, ending that six-game losing streak. Worrying times, these, for Wigan, who really didn't look that bothered about this game at all.
No, they were terribly lethargic, and their passing out from the back, I think, contributed to all three goals, didn't it?
What's become of Alcaraz? Didn't he used to be a good player?
Well,
he was responsible for one of the goals, wasn't he?
At least one of the goals. Yeah. But there you go, Bolton get a win. And, you know, we did say that when there are tough run of fixtures ended, perhaps they would start getting results. They certainly did there. Norwich, big win for them over Swansea. And what about this West Brom-Wolves game? Now, the five-game losing streak now belongs to Wolves. And K-Wolf posting in saying, listing the amount of money Mick McCarthy has spent, five league losses on the bounce, worst run in the league for over 25 years. He's spent the best part of £40 million since promoted. And two main signings this season, Roger Johnson and O'Hara, have looked woeful, bad times. Also, if that wasn't enough, they got very upset about a T-shirt saying West Brom on it. Why?
Yeah, I didn't really understand that. It was Paul Sharner's three sons had drawn the club's crest on a T-shirt, and he took his football shirt off to display this.
Right.
And a couple of Wolves players and Mick McCarthy got very annoyed about it. I think Mick McCarthy said they were taking the piss.
Yes.
It's a true story.
True story.
I can imagine Mick McCarthy getting annoyed about that, though.
I think we all can, actually. Yeah, there you go.
It's not hard to imagine Mick McCarthy getting annoyed about anything, really.
Especially when he's lost five games in a row.
Yeah, I mean, Wolves got off to a good start this season, and now it's gone spectacularly pear-shaped. The fans are turning on their own players as well. Carl Henry was sort of sarcastically jeered when he went off a couple of games ago, and so other players have had to rally round him publicly and stick up for him. So, yeah, it's not good times at Molineux.
Just to mention, because you talked about Norwich very briefly, just to say that perhaps of all the teams that I've seen this season, they're one of those which have impressed me the most in terms of the quality of the play, the organisation of the team. I saw them play at Chelsea in particular. I thought they were absolutely magnificent. And Paul Lambert is... what the job is doing in terms of learning the flexibility, tactical flexibility of that team. And we were talking with Michael a little bit before the podcast about that. You know, English players, British players are not supposed to be able to adapt tactically to three at the back, four at the back, five at the back. That's what Norwich do week in, week out, with a team that has been, has had two successive promotions, no big star in there, and they play very, very good football indeed. Mm. They're capable of playing long, they're capable of playing on the ground. I would say I've been tremendously impressed by them, and I'm absolutely sure they will stay up and establish themselves in the long term.
The introduction of Norwich and Swansea is very good for the geographical spread of clubs, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this.
No arguments there.
It was all concentrated in London and Birmingham in the northwest before, within Newcastle up top as well, and Sunderland. But now you've got a bit of width.
Nice. Not that we're not in a rush to get into Serie A this week. But anyway, big weekend in Italy as well. Michael, I know you watched the Rome derby because you were tweeting merrily throughout. It was a good game, actually, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a great game. Yeah. Rome derbies are always good games, aren't they?
No, I don't know if I'd go along with that.
Oh, but really?
Yeah. I've seen some pretty bad ones. But anyway, this wasn't like that. Early goal from Roma, terrific fight back from Lazio. Bit of a dodgy decision from the referee to send off Simon Kjær. Roma lost Kjær, ended up careless, you could say.
It was one of those incidents where, whether it was a foul or not, it's such a shame that such a minor incident has such a big impact on the game. Because you had a penalty conceded and the resulting goal. You had Roma going down to 10 men. And then because it's always a defender or a goalkeeper going off, they also have to take off a more attack-minded player. I didn't think there was that much of a tug, did you?
No, I thought it was very, very, very... it was Brocchi, wasn't it, who went down?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was very soft.
Well, I was reading Paolo Bandini's Serie A roundup before we came in to record, and he was saying that the referee in question had previous... It was Lazio fans that didn't want him involved in the game, but he ended up doing them a favour.
Paolo Tagliavento, a hairdresser. He's card happy. Yeah. But anyway, it wasn't the only good game in Serie A this weekend. There were two, I think. No, to be fair, Milan looked great value against Palermo at home. And we said that Inter were going to have trouble at Catania. And
you said.
Good
call.
It wasn't that difficult a call. When you look at Catania's record at home and Inter's record anywhere, it wasn't a surprise at all. But they're in all sorts of trouble. World champion still. Inter, the world champion club. They left the field to shouts of Serie B, Serie B from the Catania supporters. And they're only, what, goal difference away from the relegation zone. Lots of people posting in and tweeting and saying, why were there so many empty seats at the Stadio Olimpico? I have to say, this was absolutely eye-opening. It was a Lazio home game and they don't traditionally get big crowds. And whether it was anything to do with the violence that had happened in the protest, the economic protest in Rome, in the previous days, it might well have been, but really shocking to see the Stadio Olimpico with so many empty spaces there for such a big game.
It's a real problem around Europe, though, isn't it? I mean, increasingly this season, more evidently than ever before, it just feels strange to be watching these massive games with not half-empty stadiums, because I think the camera angle was, you know, not showing the true effect. But I mean, Valencia, their Champions League game. Yeah. I know there's a Europe-wide, worldwide economic problem, but it is quite sad to see.
One other thing I should mention before we go, I did give a quick shout to it before, was the fact that Little Parma went to Napoli, Big Napoli, the team that everyone's raving about this year, and beat them. Fantastic. There were some great goals in that game. And another standout performance by Sebastiano Giovinco. I just thought I'd mention that.
I think Napoli obviously regards as one of the contenders for Serie A, but they're so counter-attacking and so dependent on that. Sometimes they just allow themselves to get dominated. And if they can't find the first pass out, then they just look like they're under massive pressure for long spells of the game and end up conceding unnecessary goals.
It's an interesting point.
I wanted to ask you, when did Adrian Mutush sign for Cesena?
During the summer.
He got sent off yesterday.
Mm.
I thought he was still at Fiorentina.
No,
my finger is firmly on the pulse.
He still hasn't paid his £17 million to Chelsea, by the way.
Funny that.
Yeah.
Well, the court case is not over because it's gone to, is it the European Court? Court rights, something like that. They've managed to find, you think every time, oh, it's the last stage, but no, there's always another court of appeal, which has to do something about it. So no, he still hasn't paid a penny.
Mm. Well, presumably he doesn't have that kind of money. So
I'd guess not.
And if he has, it's probably in giving it to his wife. He will need to be very nice to for the rest
of his life. He has a complicated series
of
properties all over the world, registered in various different names, I think. We had a discussion about this.
Is he the W.C. Fields of football?
Why, was he big into property?
Did you not know the W.C. Fields story when he died?
What happened?
He had salted his money in such a huge number of bank accounts And all of these were consigned, if I'm not mistaken, a little book, but with written in code. So nobody ever found where the money was, and he was a multi-millionaire, and nobody ever inherited a penny from W.C. Fields, wow, because nobody could trace the money back. And the banks, you know, they didn't necessarily volunteer the information.
They should do a film with that, with like Tom Hanks as this professor going with the book trying to...
Why not?
These are just ideas I'm throwing out there. Fantastic. We'll be back on Thursday in our big prize question featuring Football Weekly Extra. In the meantime, thank you very much, Philippe, and indeed Michael. Eye-opening and informative as ever. Barry Glendenning, we never got to talk about your 20-year school reunion.
Yeah, it was very alcohol-drenched.
Right.
And we're all 20 years older and not 20 years wiser.
Who'd made the most of themselves in the 20 years?
Well, I've made about an extra stone since.
Right. Was anyone who'd become something really extraordinary?
Not that I'm aware of. Quite a few guys.
Could you recognise everyone?
No, there was three people I didn't recognise.
Right.
One with horrifically embarrassing consequences.
Why?
Because I mistook him for someone else and he was not one bit happy about it.
Right.
But that
wasn't the worst thing that happened, I'm sure.
Nothing bad happened. It was all very jovial and just everyone drank too much. And I'd say I'm probably not the only class of 91 alumni suffering this morning. So it was well worth it. Great to see everyone.
All right, excellent.
And some of them are listeners to this pod.
There you go. What's the name of the school, Barry?
Cistercian College, Roscrea.
All right, then. Excellent. Well, many thanks then, listeners. And many thanks to guest producer Phil for stepping in. For producer Ben, who had a growing family commitment.
As did Sean Ingle on Friday.
Oh, did he?
Yes, daughter Rosalie. So now he's got two little girls.
All right, excellent. Very good. Well, best wishes to all then. Enjoy the week, and we'll be back on Thursday.
The Guardian Football Weekly, sponsored by PES 2012. Forever evolving, forever football, forever Pro Evo.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.